Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, and welcome back to An Adventure in History. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital, here tonight with Mac Burns, Executive Director of the Clatsop County Historical Society, who has been jet-setting, not across the country, across part of the country. Part of the country. Welcome home.
Which is funny. I'm glad you said, like, I hope you didn't have a great time, because I've, like, warned people I'm going to be gone for a week. And I usually tell them I'm helping my mother move after my father passed. She's waited a year, but the house is too big. She wants to move into a retirement home near one of her children, and that ended up being my brother in Florida.
Not you.
Not me.
Shocking. If she chose Florida.
Oh, she would have come here in a heartbeat if she could have found something local
right.
that she really wanted. Because she wants like a it's kind of a... You know, independent living with mm-hmm. then I can step down into the, I eat in the dining room all the time and they come and check on me every day. And then she thinks she'll eventually need to move into a memory care center. And she wanted kind of all-in-one shopping.
Yep.
And that's just not possible locally. And it would have had to be Portland. And she's now four blocks from my brother.
I know.
So, so it wasn't a fun trip. We're there to clean out the house and we had these pod, U-pack pods that you have to fill and then take stuff to the dump that we don't want. And so people are saying, though, oh, I hope you have a good time.
I know.
And I'm like, it's really not a vacation.
We got to bring back some of your dad's letters, though. Can we do that?
We did find some more.
Okay.
Yeah, there's just a lot of humorous things from
them.
His life.
His dad wrote these. I'm talking to our guest now. His dad wrote these letters to anyone if he ever had a complaint. Or not always a complaint, but he wanted to let
his comments.
Right, constructive criticism.
In his and it wasn't just in his retirement we discovered, because I found letters when he was a college student writing.
Very detailed, and usually with the solution in it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like it was his hobby.
Full refund or whatever, and it was they're comical.
I'll take my business elsewhere.
So, we have a good guest tonight. So I know him pretty well, lives very close, so the family's nearby. If you want to just say who you are and just very briefly, because we're gonna come back.
My name is Stephen Renz. I'm a resident of Hammond, Oregon, right across the street from Alana for the last 3 years. Moved up here with the Coast Guard and I retired last year.
Wow. Okay. Terrific. So how troublesome are the Quailas as neighbors?
They have their moments, but overall,
yes, we do.
Overall, they're pretty good.
Of course we do. We have a neighborhood watch text group, just so you
do
know.
Do you really?
We do. The moms do, but the dads have another one. I don't know what it's for.
It's not used as much.
It's not used for a neighborhood watch. I know that.
Okay, and is it really like a useful watch, or is it like the neighbor in Bewitched from years ago that was always like peering over the fence and...
Oh, we're a little both. A little of both, and then also a, you know, meet in someone's backyard for a drink, too.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Sometimes suspicious cars or people that are walking through the neighborhood.
We got it all. So. Yeah. Once it was Mark. Mark was caught on somebody's camera running by, and I had to be like, that's my husband. He's out jogging. I know. It's hard to believe, but.
Somebody reported just because he was jogging?
Well, they just couldn't tell that it was him.
He looked suspicious.
Yeah, of course he did.
So I remember one time, John Gutenberg, I gave him a ride home. And as John can, he tells stories. And we're sitting in my car kind of giggling and laughing as he's telling a long story. And it couldn't have been more than 5 minutes. But a neighbor called the sheriff's office, thinking like a drug deal was going down or something.
And then the
kicker, the neighbor that called... was one of my gift shop employees at the time.
That's funny, though.
I was like, really? A, you didn't recognize the car. B, you didn't know it was in front of John's house. And come on. So, all right. Well, we've got to get right to it.
Let's do it.
The big history highlights, things that happen tomorrow, September 19th. So are we ready to go?
I'm ready.
1849, the first commercial laundry established in Oakland, California.
Ooh.
I find that
like
strange.
Like a laundromat?
Yeah.
Is that what that is?
I find that strangely late, and I should have investigated this more. Huh. Because you always picture in the old West towns, and especially during the gold rush in California, right. laundries. So, okay. 1849, I mean, okay, gold rush is beginning, but that still seems like maybe they should have already been in existence.
And then isn't it a losing battle? All that dirt? My gosh.
Probably. So, I wonder where people in uniform locally get their stuff laundry since the laundromat went out of business.
I don't know. Steve, do you know?
Because you got Coast Guard, you got police, you got sheriffs, you got...
The Coast Guard Exchange would do it for the Coast Guard. We could do dry cleaning there.
Oh, oh really? You can. Yeah.
Just for
Coast Guard.
Just for people who have access to the exchange. So retirees and veterans with disabilities and active duty.
Okay. Great. That's good.
Okay, well, that knocks out a big portion of the people. Right. I'm wondering where are they going now. Okay. Well, glad you're here. That was helpful. 1876, the first carpet sweeper is patented by Melville Bissell.
There we go.
There we go.
Still a good brand.
Of Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Okay.
Mr. Bissell, Melville. I like his name is Melville. 1881, President James Garfield dies.
Oh.
You know he's high on my list, even though he's only around for like 9 months as president.
That's why.
1893, New Zealand is the first to give universal women's suffrage.
I liked that one.
I hate the word suffrage.
Well, you could also
the
say
vote.
The right to vote. Yes. Yep.
So way to go, New Zealand.
Yeah.
Kiwis.
And they're still rocking it with their female prime minister.
They are.
Yeah. A mom.
There we go.
Yeah.
And they have Lord of the Rings. I don't really care about Lord of the Rings.
They have lots of good movies.
But my son likes Lord of the Rings. Yeah. So, all right. Let's see. 1950, the UN rejects membership of China's People's Republic.
Oh.
Ooh, that causes trouble. 1959, Khrushchev is barred from visiting Disneyland.
Oh, interesting.
And I left this back at the office. I should have brought it because it's kind of an amazing rant that he goes off on. He's visiting America for like 2 weeks, and he's in Los Angeles. He wanted to see Hollywood, so they take him there. They take him to like 20th Century Fox. He sees a movie, The Can-Can, or Can-Can being filmed, and they do a little dance number for him, and Frank Sinatra is kind of hosting a dinner or a lunch for him, and then the head of the studio, I think it was, gives a speech and kind of goes off on, you said you were going to bury the West and, you know, we're not going to do that. And, you know, isn't capitalism pretty good? You've seen some good stuff here. And Khrushchev kind of goes off on the guy.
Well, sure.
And then right after that, they say, oh, by the way, the trip to Disneyland this afternoon, canceled, can't do it. Security purposes.
Oh.
And he kind of goes off as, what, has it been taken over by gangsters? What is there? And he
business.
He gets really angry. He doesn't stamp a shoe.
That's, yeah.
You know I like that.
I know you do.
Let's see. But our history highlight of the day, I think had the most impact on history, 1778. Ooh. The Continental Congress passes the first budget of the United States.
Oh, that had to be hard.
You bet, because all the states are like, wait a minute now, there's going to be an overall budget? I thought we all had our budgets.
Yeah.
So for the first time ever.
Mark cringes when it's budget time for the county.
I'm sure he does.
Oh, man, it takes so long. And they don't even do all the hard work. I mean, that's the staff.
And what is it, like 30 million, 60 million?
Right, yeah.
Can it's you imagine? Well, back then.
Right. Back then it was probably pretty small.
It's probably like 10 grand. Yeah,
but still, grand. Having to agree on something.
Yeah.
And
exactly. All those people, yeah. So our history has
a good one.
The United States has its first budget.
You missed one, 1985, the Parents Music Resource Center, formed by Tipper Gore.
Oh, no.
Yep. And other political wives lobby for parental advisory stickers on music packaging. It just doesn't seem like her.
I watched those.
Okay.
When did Dee Snider and Frank Zappa become the voice of reason?
So Tipper Gore, that was her contribution in 1985.
There we go.
Yeah, early.
And they did actually put not actual grades, but they did just put warning
just,
labels.
Yep, parental advisory stickers.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which I think is then became like, this is what you buy, right? This is the sticker. And then the other one was 1955, Argentina's president Juan Perón is overthrown by rebels.
No.
Have you seen the movie?
I have seen the movie, and I saw the play on Broadway back in the 80s.
Oh, right. Okay.
And the last time we actually somehow mentioned, actually, no, it was with Julie. It wasn't with you.
Yeah.
I sang.
Oh.
Because I remember our guest was John Gutenberger. And they said, wow, you sound just like Madonna.
I guess.
And then Julie said, and he's dressed like Madonna, too. And it was pretty funny.
You're right. I didn't do that one.
So I'm not going to sing it this time.
Okay, good.
Because I've already done that.
And we have a good guest here. So, Steve, let's just get right to it. So what brought you to the Pacific Northwest?
Well, after my wife was also in the Coast Guard. She retired out of the Coast Guard in 2019. And I was due for transfer. And I haven't quite retched or met my 20 years to be able to retire yet. So we wanted to go somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. That's where I started my career in the Coast Guard, and that's where me and my wife met. So we wanted to move back up here with the kids, and we just liked the area and everything. And so I got orders to the Coast Guard Cutter Steadfast, which was right here in downtown.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we came up here in 2019 and stayed on the Steadfast for 2 years, and about halfway through the tour, we decided we liked it here, so we started making plans on staying permanently.
Nice.
So I didn't know you guys had met here. So go back then a couple years.
Met here in the Coast Guard.
Right, or met in the Northwest.
In Oregon, yeah.
Okay.
So my first unit out of boot camp was stationed Umpqua River in Winchester Bay, Oregon.
Okay.
And so Amy ended up getting stationed there, too. I think she showed up a month or so after I did, and we met and became friends, and that kind of evolved. And so, yeah, ever since then, we've kind of tried to get back. We got stuck in California for quite a while.
But. So we're jumping the gun because I want to get into your background and why you joined the Coast Guard and where you grew up and things like that. But I'm fascinated by, I was going to make a joke about, is it frowned upon for fraternization among the troops, so to speak?
There's different rules for it.
But more importantly, like knowing that most Coast Guard folks get transferred every 2 years.
Yeah.
Are you allowed to request transfers together so you have the same post? Do they pay attention to that at all? Or
yes.
Are you forced to go to different places?
Once you're married.
No, once you're married, yes. Okay. I mean, you can request whatever you want. Typically, when it's time to transfer, a list opens up and shows you what units that you're qualified for is open that year. And so you can kind of get the two lists together and mix and match. So sometimes you don't always get your dream billet is what they call it, but... You know, you'll get, as long as you're close, it all depends on what your priorities are.
Is it usually like within your top five or top three that you get?
The way we would word it, there's a little area in there where you can put your own comments to the detailers of the name of the person that would send you places. And so we would tell them, you know, our first priority is to be stationed together. Our second priority is for certain areas and then this and that. And we would rank our certain billets accordingly.
Okay.
So.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't know.
I didn't know that either.
I knew they could stay together.
It never occurred to me if there was a married couple. Right. What do you do?
Well, it happens quite a bit.
You're supposed to try to do it for inner service, too.
Wow.
So if a Coastie is married to a Navy person or Air Force or Army, they try to get them as close as possible.
Wow. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. They should, because they'll probably lose one if they don't.
Yep.
So. Right.
Okay, so back up. Where'd you grow up, and why'd you join the Coast Guard?
So I grew up in Southern California, a town called Bellflower, which is right outside of Long Beach. Didn't really have too much of a direction after high school. I did about a year and a half at junior college and wasn't feeling like that was the fit for me, and still didn't have a direction where I wanted to go after that. So one day I was driving home from work and drove by a Coast Guard recruiting office and stopped.
Wow.
What was your job at that point? Where were you working?
I was working in a warehouse as kind of a forklift mechanic.
Yeah.
On a minor level.
Sure.
And then just kind of somebody that would do whatever, stack pallets and do all this stuff.
And was there anything in particular about the Coast Guard, or if you'd driven past a Marines or an Air Force, would you have pulled in there?
No, what had me for the Coast Guard was, this was in 2000. And at that time, you know, there was no major conflict going on or anything. And so I wanted to go to a service that was trained to do or did what they were trained for every day. So the Coast Guard, I figured that's going to be the one to where, you know, you're trained to do something and that job is there every day, instead of, in my mind, it was, you know, getting trained to do something just in case something happens. So I wanted to be able to kind of hit the ground running.
Okay.
And so because you went in, I mean, because you are a mechanic. I mean, you're, so you were already doing something with that skill set. So how did that transfer over then when you...
I transferred over okay. I mean, I had a basic understanding, and You know, when you join the Coast Guard, you kind of have options. You're not really trained in anything but basic seamanship for the most part, in boot camp. And then I did 2 years in Winchester Bay as basically just somebody that was trained in basic seamanship. And then I went to my technical school, which was in Yorktown, Virginia. Hmm. So that's where I got my mechanics training from the Coast Guard, or the basic mechanic training.
Mm-hmm. And that's just to keep the boat going, right? I mean, is that?
Yeah. Yep. So I've worked on everything from a 21-foot small boat to a 378-foot high endurance cutter.
Wow.
And what kind of specialization for different, like if you get reassigned to a larger one, say the Steadfast versus the 20-footer, that's just another motor, Mac, you idiot? Or is it that you have to go to some specialized, okay, now I'm going to be working on this kind of an engine?
So they have the main technical school is called an A school. And so that's your basic training for mechanics. And so what they have is they have C schools, which are more specialized and more narrowed down to what you're going to be working on. So they have those schools too. So like before Steadfast, I would get a little bit more training that's specialized in what Steadfast would have. And most of those schools are also in Yorktown, Virginia, but they give you those depending on where you're at and where you're going.
So on any of your boats, did you ever have a time where like it was really crucial, like the boat was sinking or you needed to move because the storm's coming in, like anything?
I've been fortunate enough to not been taken on too much water.
too much water.
Too much.
See, water. It's all relative.
The big cutters that I was on, they were both old. As you know, the Steadfast was commissioned in 1968.
Oh, that's amazing.
So there are certain parts that would fail, and we would have to figure out how to patch it up and get it.
And when does it fail? Like, does it fail when you're in the middle, like, of the ocean? Like, I mean,
yeah. Sometimes it fails over at the pier, and sometimes it fails out in the middle of the ocean, and we got to do our best to keep it going and not waste the whole mission.
Right.
So, but yeah, I mean, sometimes it would be just a mistake on somebody's operating. And then sometimes it would just be some of the systems you can't really tell. You can't really inspect them inside out, like the pipe thickness and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. sometimes we would spring a leak in a pipe.
And, oh, interesting.
You know, start taking on water that way.
And when you talk about the mission, what were your missions? Did you always have one mission or assignments? How does that?
I had quite a few different missions, anything from search and rescue at some of my small boat stations, which small boat stations are more relegated to just local areas, like Cape Disappointment is a small boat station out here. And then, you know, on the cutters, the missions can very much vary from Homeland Defense to working in cooperation with DOD. We would do a lot of fisheries training when I was on the 378-footer, the Monroe. We'd go up to the Bering Sea and deal with the king crab fisheries and search and rescue up there. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the bigger cutters, too, like the Steadfast, pretty much all I did was counter-narcotics down off of Central America.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys did quite a bit.
Yeah.
Like, made the news every time.
I was going to say, if you just retired, there was one huge catch that you guys had on the Steadfast in the last, like, 2 years, wasn't there?
Yeah. Three years. That was my first patrol on the boat, actually. Wow. Yeah. Oh, that was a record-breaking patrol for a 210-foot cutter.
And then I recall, didn't you break down some, like, not here, down in South America, or was it California?
That was a long patrol. We broke down a couple times.
Oh, okay. I know. Well, like you hear about like all of this that they do, and then you're like, and they're stuck for another week or two.
Yeah. We initially got stuck, I think, in Guatemala or something like that.
Gosh. And then,
you know, had to patch it up to get back into the States, and got stuck in Los Angeles for a little bit till we got patched up the right way.
So going back, you joined in 2000. Did you enlist at that time?
I left for boot camp February 28th of 2000.
And then a year later, year and a half later, 9/11 happens. How does that change what you're doing? That just you personally, I mean, you're in the service.
So for my career path, not my overall career path, but what I did right after my technical school, it changed quite a bit because I was assigned to a unit. In November of 2002, I got assigned to, I think it was the second one that was stood up in the United States, but it was called the Maritime Safety and Security Team. And their primary duties were doing anti-terrorism, stuff like that. And mostly just, you know, keeping watch over military outloads when they're loading ships up with whatever, either ammunition or something like that. Just any sort of asset that would, you know, be that you'd think a terrorist would look upon and say, yeah, I want to go mess up that asset.
Mm-hmm. And what does a terrorist look like on the water? I mean, because you hear about pirates and, of course, other countries, too.
Luckily, I never ran into one.
That's good.
But our job was mostly to do security zones over, to call them high-valued assets, mm-hmm. Just to make sure. And we would go up to every boat in the security zone. Our job was just to enforce it. And some people would drive by and not know that they're coming into a security zone. So we would just notify the public that this is a security zone and you can't go around here right now. And it'll be a security zone until this time. And,
right.
You know, but we also had capabilities to thwart an attempted terrorist attempt, sure, as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so.
And is that part of your training at all? Because I assume that there's part of you that's just like, hey, I'm a mechanic, dude. I don't want to be, let me just be down here taking care of the engine. But then I also think all hands on deck here.
Some of your training depends on where you go to. So and at that point, you know, I didn't really request to go to that unit, but that's where I ended up at. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up getting trained specifically for that unit.
Mm-hmm. And where was that one?
That one initially was in Yorktown, Virginia.
Okay.
And then we covered, at that point, we covered the whole Eastern Seaboard. And there was only, I think, four of the teams open in the United States. There was one in Seattle, one in Los Angeles, one in Texas, and then Virginia.
Oh, okay.
Then I transferred for that one. They were starting up new ones all around the country as they could come along. So I was what's called a plank owner of the team in San Francisco. So a plank owner is the first, you're part of the first crew of a unit.
Hmm.
So,
wow. Yeah.
So how large were the crews or how big were those boats?
Those are 25 foot boats.
Okay.
So they're made to be trailered fast and nimble and fast. And,
so it's pretty small. Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty small team too. Not very.
Yeah. Well, the team was pretty big. We had kind of different sections of it.
Okay.
But, I think we had enough people to man, I think it was six boat crews at a time.
Okay.
And six boats. So.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, decent. That's an interesting, because like here we have the one cutter, and of course Cape Disappointment is a different
section. Throughout your career, have you always been assigned to ships or boats, or have you been like the air station out here doesn't really have any?
I've never been at a unit without boats.
Okay.
There's that one too.
There are, like facilities, mechanic jobs and stuff like that, which I have done at some of my units, but every unit I've been at has been a primary boat unit.
Because I knew a 20-year-old guy who was a helicopter mechanic that never was assigned to a ship.
Well, that's only ever. There's two different types of mechanics in the Coast Guard, and there's aviation and surface. That's what they call them. So
what did your wife do? Well, she's in the Coast Guard. What's her specialty?
So she was what's called a bosun mate. So she was a boat driver.
Okay.
So, and she drove boats anywhere from, I think, 19 foot all the way up to a 418 foot boat.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So. Yeah. And what is your favorite vessel that you've been assigned to? If it's not the Steadfast.
My favorite one was probably a newer one. It's a 45 foot. It's called a response boat medium. Mm-hmm. And it was just fast, nimble. It could do a lot of things. And it was diesel powered, which I love.
And where was that one?
That was in Los Angeles.
Okay.
So.
And you guys were in Southern California, you said, for quite a while.
Yeah, we did 16 years total in California.
Okay.
So 8 years total in the Bay Area, 4 years in San Diego, and then 4 years in Los Angeles area.
Oh, my goodness. And they have two young kids in grade school. And towards the end of your career here, you were gone for large chunks of time.
Yeah, about half the year.
Yeah, wow. Quite a bit. You miss holidays, if the schedule allowed. And then you also were serving during COVID, which I'm sure was lots of fun, going in and out of different countries.
Yeah.
How did that change working together in such a small place with your shipmates?
Well, you're kind of used to it because you're out for a few weeks at a time without pulling into port. But then what really changed it is, you know, sometimes the good thing about going on those patrols is going to see other places and, you know, going to see these other towns down in wherever it was, in Mexico or Panama or Costa Rica, and that all pretty much came to a stop. So instead of having port calls, we would have we would kind of be stuck at the pier for a little bit. So they give us a break, but sometimes we were allowed off the boat and just in the immediate, you know, pier vicinity. And then in other places, we weren't even allowed off the boat.
So you're in these gorgeous countries and you look at it.
But at the same time, most of it was up to the other countries too. So a lot of it was Mexico, and Mexico wasn't allowing anybody in. So pretty much everything was shut down for tourists and stuff. We were actually underway when COVID hit. So it was kind of weird because it seemed like the world changed from the time we left here to the time we get home. I think we left in February and we came home in April.
Oh my gosh.
Of 2020. So,
right. And all the rest of us are like, stay away from us.
Yeah.
We don't know where you've been.
Well, they were out, so they were safe. I know. They should never have come back.
But right. So where would you go back? Would you go back anywhere to visit any of these places?
One of my favorite port calls in Mexico is a little town called Huatuco, Mexico. And it was a very small one. Yeah. And it was a place that, I guess it's a place where a lot of the Mexicans go to go on vacation. So it was very small, you know, more localized and friendly. And you ask the cab drivers, you know, is it dangerous here? Do you have any issues with cartel or anything? And they say, no, not down here. So it's a little more southern Mexico. So,
yeah,
but it was just a very nice, you know, you can find a small little hotel and they treat you really nice. And it just seemed more like a family oriented stop than some of these bigger ones like Puerto Vallarta or something like that.
So you did almost 20 years in the Coast Guard?
I did a little over 21 and a half.
21 and a half. Okay. Yeah. Retiring just because you could, because you had little kids and didn't want to be away for that long. What actually leads to the retirement?
COVID had a little bit to do with it, but at the same point, I think we just, we got to a point to where we didn't want to, move with the kids anymore. And, you know, we kind of looked at finances and what we could and couldn't do and said, you know what, this is a good time to just call it quits and stop being away from the kids and have some more family time.
That's great. Yeah. And what are you doing besides family time? Is that enough?
Well, you like it here. So, yeah. I mean, the reasons why you chose to stay here are.
I like the fishing. I like the hunting. I like, just being able to go to the beach. It's a 5-minute drive from the beach and stuff like that. We go on local hikes quite a bit. And so it's just a beautiful area. And our neighborhood is, I think, second to none. We
except love for those one neighbors.
Except for those ones.
What's your favorite hike locally?
We do Fort Stevens quite a bit. Pretty much every morning, drop the kids off for school and take the dog for a walk at Fort Stevens. So we pretty much know all the trails there. Nice. It's nice that the summer's over, so they're a little bit more empty.
Yeah.
Well, I could do without the banana slugs.
Yeah.
See, when you live at the beach, we actually go to the beach.
Yes.
I mean, it is. It's so nice. It's right there, folks.
And I do have to comment because you've got an awesome beard.
Oh, thank you.
this is one of the moments where I wish we were on video instead of just audio. But I assume you were not allowed to have one when you were in the Coast Guard.
No, I started growing this the day of my retirement ceremony. So it's been growing
like
since
the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
June 10th of 2021 is the last time I shaved it.
And his wife said, okay, obviously.
Yeah. She said she likes it. I said, all right.
Well, that is awesome. That's really great. And what a great life. And you did a wonderful 21 years of service to the United States. And,
yes. Thank you.
That's always appreciated. And you probably impacted tons of different people, even though she baited you. You didn't give us any like really amazing stories of rescues or anything like that. But I'm sure that
he
you
kept
made a
the
difference.
Boat afloat
you
is kept, what we learned.
You kept the boat going. So. That's incredible.
Thanks, Steve, for joining us tonight.
All right. Thanks for listening. Go make some history. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.